I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. And for this episode of GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast, we are very happy to have David Bonardeau join us. David is a seasoned environmental and natural resource management practitioner with over 15 years of experience. He's worked and lived across the globe, from Malawi, Ghana, Ethiopia, and Zimbabwe, to Vietnam, Myanmar, Thailand, Mexico, and Peru. He has worked and consulted for the World Bank, World Wildlife Fund, Conservation International, Windrock International, USAID in Ghana, SGS Environment, Develop Alternatives, Inc., and McKinsey Social Initiative. At an earlier stage of his life, he consulted for the BBC Natural History Unit on a number of wildlife documentaries, including The Life of Mammals and Andes to Amazon, which he was working alongside Sir David Attenborough in Costa Rica, Venezuela, and Ecuador. He's an avid photographer with a focus on landscapes, portraits, nature, and photojournalism, with his photos published in World Bank, USAID, Conservation International, Survival Quarterly, and Roll Call Publications. And he's also featured in Wildlife Heroes' book. And today, we're happy to have David Bonardeau join us, who's Director of the Environment for PAC.org. David, welcome to GDP.
Thank you very much, Bob. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great. And we've got you in Oslo, Norway today, an exciting place when it comes to innovative policies for environmental sustainability and looking towards a more greener earth. So I hope all is well for you today in Oslo.
Indeed, absolutely. It is actually a pleasure to be in this very sort of forward-looking, progressive country when it comes to environmental issues. And so, I'm looking forward to learn more. I've only been here a month.
Well, excellent. And forward-looking is, I think, something that many of us are actively desiring. 2021 is going to be another year for the record books in a few ways. We're still rolling through the global pandemic with challenges across the globe in various different ways. But the other issue with 2021 is that the IPCC, that's the International Panel for Climate Change, released its most damning report yet to say that the impacts of climate change now in 2021 are irreversible. It's a time now when the New York Times has a calculator that shows you the present day temperature versus that of when you were born in your hometown. The West Coast of North America is burning. The East Coast is suffocating in humidity. What are we up against in 2021? And I just want to ask my first question to you as the Director of Environment for PACT. What is it that your role is with PACT, and how are you approaching some of these challenges, these environmental challenges that we're facing today?
Where to start? No, absolutely. It is quite daunting. And in fact, I hearken back to my days when I was actually started my first job with Friends of the Earth Scotland, responding to a white paper on climate change for the government to adhere to the Kyoto Protocol. And I think back to all those years and think, geez, how many opportunities have we lost to really not be in this position now where we are so close to that, what we call that tipping point. And yes, I mean, this report really does lay that out in very stark terms, in very unequivocal terms, that we are, we humans have been partly to blame. There are, of course, naysayers that say otherwise, but the science is irrefutable. So 2021, I mean, for PACT, we are a very, I wouldn't say a standard USAID contractor, but we're a medium-sized nonprofit organization that works with and for donors such as USID, DFID, what is now FCDO in the UK, and others, you know, GIZ in Germany and the World Bank. And we cut across, you know, governance, livelihoods, environment, and even sort of artisanal mining, formalizing that sector. And so my portfolio is a relatively small one. I mean, we're still $75 million in projects, but our focus is primarily around community-based natural resource management. So supporting communities to essentially manage in tandem with, in a participatory way, with local government structures, for example, fisheries in Malawi or forestry in Cambodia, protected areas in Madagascar. We've been a little less focused on the climate change piece, only because, you know, the way we were first originally structured, but we are moving towards that because it's an issue that we just cannot ignore. And so many of our projects have components of you know, climate adaptation, climate mitigation, or climate resilience. For example, our Madagascar project, Hey Tao, is working. Hey Tao means know-how in Malagasy. And we're doing exactly that. We are creating the knowledge base for civil society groups, small local NGOs, to understand how to better manage and adapt to climate change. So we're developing climate resilient livelihoods for the communities in and around protected areas, for example. We're also doing something green in Southeast Asia, working with a USAID project there. Called Green Invest Asia, where we are working with local, or rather, sorry, multinational corporations or regional, or in some cases, domestic private sector organizations to green their supply chains, but specifically to reduce their emissions, their greenhouse gas emissions from their supply chains. And these are agri-businesses, forestry business. So it's looking at how to reduce emissions through land use and land management changes. So that very much is a project focused on this. It's a relatively new one. And it's the target is reducing 25 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalents over 5 years, or at least pledged reductions. So that's not to say, you know, PACT in the past was involved on climate mitigation. We supported in tandem with Terra Global Capital doing a Red Plus project, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation in Cambodia. And we were doing the community engagement piece, you know, in terms of ensuring that the community had free and prior informed consent around these issues. And we're very much part and parcel of what was being done. But we're also now, and what I'm doing quite recently, is looking inwardly, sort of at a corporate level, because we say we need to do this, others need to do that. But what about ourselves? Are we walking the talk or walking the walk? I'm not sure how that term goes these days. And so I just recently finished doing a carbon footprint, an assessment, a baseline assessment of PACT's operational corporate-wide activities across our 27 country offices. We've done that in consultation with and in partnership with South Pole, which is one of these carbon consultancies. So that's just the beginning, right? This is to get us to understand what our footprint is, to then be able to then set science-based targets, and then ultimately reduce our emissions in time. So yeah, so a lot going on, but that's one of the more exciting pieces that's happening right now, which not many NGOs necessarily are doing this. It's the private sector, it's the big multinational corporations like Nike and, you know, Nestle, Unilever, but not, you know, small, medium, you know, nonprofit organizations such as PACT. But we feel that we need to be able to put the money in where our mouth is, and our effort where our mouth is.
This is a great point, David. Thank you so much for that. And I, you know, we let's circle back to this, you know, how it's not just the big multinationals who have a role in assessing carbon footprinting or global impact, but smaller groups as well. You know, we see every time an airline ticket is purchased, there's always the choice to pay a little bit extra to offset your carbon if you wish to do that. But, you know, what I'm just, some of the projects that you've mentioned there, you know, there's certainly an environmental focus to all of them, but I'm also hearing that there's other economic and social benefits that can come there as well. And, you know, I guess sort of a perhaps an awkward question is your portfolio really just environment, or is it also about understanding that, you know, environmental issues, especially amid a climate crisis, are integrated in any development project, and that the incentives to pursue environmental betterment may not just be from, you know, the perspective of let's reduce carbon or try to, you know, clean a river, but that they're actually, this approach is about improving systems itself.
Absolutely. So yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, these projects I mentioned are, funded by biodiversity funding streams of the USAID, for example, or sustainable landscapes mechanisms. But they absolutely have a development aspect because, of course, if not, USAID would not put them out to tender. So absolutely. For example, you know, the project in Madagascar, we're working with local communities to improve their livelihoods. And to do so, we are assuring that they are climate resilient so that in the future, when, for example, the climate gets hotter in a certain valley and harvest times become shorter or further up the altitude, up the mountain, they need to be able to adapt. They need to be able to have the seedlings drought resistant seedlings, for example, or understand how to manage water better because, you know, suddenly they're not able to access water as they used to. And so this is very much an environmental as well as a food security issue, as well as an economic issue, a livelihoods issue, and a health one. I mean, just the pandemic, as you mentioned in your intro, is a prime example of where we need to focus our efforts. And that, you know, there was some polemic as to how exactly COVID-19 came to be, whether it was from a civet or a bat in a wet market in Wuhan, China. But we do know that it was zoonotic and that it came from an animal and jumped into a human. And so, and this is only going to get worse. And there's evidence out there that we are getting more and more pandemics, SARS and Ebola and even, you know, HIV, AIDS was a zoonotic disease. And there, it's happening more and more because we are not, because we are actually encroaching into our wildlife spaces and habitats and wilderness areas more and more as our, we have a burgeoning population. So it's all absolutely intertwined. And what we've been pushing for donors to do is to push out more solicitations and expressions of interest focused on integrated solutions, rather than being very siloed, very focused just on biodiversity, just on governance, but just on health, but rather having a project that meets communities where they are. And by that, I mean, communities don't just focus on one aspect or another. They have to deal with everything. They have to deal with water and sanitation hygiene. They have to deal with corruption in their governance systems on a daily basis. They have to consider issues to do with solid waste management, and so on and so forth. And so we have to design programs that works across the full spectrum of issues that pertain to their lives. So that's something PACT has been doing, and we actually co-founded a platform called LOCUS, L-O-C-U-S, which is looking at exactly this, is to show the evidence base for why integrated programming works. And there's evidence in the past that it didn't work when it was very focused, for example, in integrated conservation development projects, ICDPs, didn't work because they were very focused on primarily on the conservation part and then looked at the other aspects almost as a secondary aspect. It truly right. has to be integrated. And so we're pushing that in our Hey Tao project, working with a network there of CSOs, civil society organizations, called Mihari, Tafi Mahavo, sorry, which is looking at population health and environment projects and activities for that very reason, because in that way we have a greater assurance of success because you get greater buy-in from the community when they're looking at short-term gains such as health, while the long-term horizon aspects of environment may get less billing in the eyes of the community. So we garner in a way better and more interest from the community in the short term with health aspects, for example, or access to finance, and then they're more willing to support us on the environmental issues. So it's a little bit of a tit for tat, but of course the environmental aspect has a direct impact on them, but they don't necessarily see that in the short term.
You know, great points, David. And I think that with many donors who are, you know, looking for organizations like PACT to take on some of these initiatives, that the more siloed initiatives get today, the more challenges that they'll actually face in executing projects and getting buy-in, as you mentioned. One of the things that sort of keeps resonating in my head with the way the world is organize itself during the pandemic is the very concept of adaptation and the sense that this is not something where, you know, I'm thinking back to the earlier days of development post-war 1940s, where a few magic bullets of science and technology will solve all of the world's problems. We're not in that world anymore. I think back to the president of Singapore, the prime minister of Singapore, who is Lee Kuan Yew, who said the most important innovation in the 20th century was the air conditioner. And and he was looking at that from the one point of view that Singapore is famously hot and muggy. And if it was to do anything as a city state in terms of engaging globally, then air conditioning would have to be part of the picture. But that's only one focus on the bigger issues of the adaptation. And we are seeing that going forward with a damning climate report, with a world that's been kind of tossed up and locked down and have its economic pillars sort of thrown around a bit. What can we be doing to better engage in this world of adaptation? And just one of your earlier points there about the carbon footprinting, I'm thinking, you know, pre-pandemic, air travel was pretty much at a global maximum. You know, more planes, bigger airports, more people using aircraft to commute to their jobs between cities. And this was highly celebrated. This was the way things were. And the pandemic forced many airlines to take a break, or at least reduce their capacity in some way. And now that we're kind of coming back to the supposed normalcy, you know, will things like air travel just be put back on as that essential element to how the globe works? Or is it time to think about the necessity for air travel in that way? And I'm thinking students. You know, we've taught many students in international development studies that the way to succeed in this field is to get on a plane and go far away from where you're often from, connect with communities, and do work on the ground. Do you see that continuing in the way that it's transpired in the past?
That is definitely an issue that we're grappling with right now. As part of this baseline that we did, we looked at our scope 1, scope 2, scope 3 emissions, right? Direct and indirect emissions. And what we saw was that actually 66%, rather, sorry, no, over 70% of our emissions are from our scope 3 emissions, indirect emissions, particularly around travel, both land and air travel. And of that, 66% of it is actually air travel. So we decided that we obviously need to look at this issue, and thankfully we have a fantastic new CEO and president of PACT, Caroline Anstey, who gets it, who understands the issues, who has a long term view. She chairs, you know, the Sustainable Markets Working Group of the Prince William Trust in the UK, and so she gets this and understands it. So she tasked us to look at this issue specifically around air travel, and it's not an easy one, right? Because if we reduce our travel, are we becoming less competitive? You know, vis-a-vis our competitors in this space, will we not be able to develop and design programs that really have a finger on the pulse of the community that we're working for, you know, the beneficiaries, as often is termed, or are we going to, or can we actually do this without as much travel? And so we did a very quick back of the envelope type assessment of this, and found that actually we've been able to keep to our programmatic targets over the last year and a half when there's been almost zero travel. We've been able to win new projects and new proposals. So things have been able to tick along. So why can't we continue in the same thing? Now, you will say, and one thing I think that if we were to do so, I should take a step back. The way we've been able to do this is we put much more onus on our local staff. And I think that is exactly, that's the raison d'être and the MO of PACT. It's developing the capacity of our local organizations, local civil society groups, to do the work for themselves and not have the likes of PACT or Chemonix or Tetra Tech, you know, parachute in, do the work and not leave behind, you know, that capacity to do the work. So we've been able to develop the capacity of our local partners and our local staff to do more remote work. While that was not as in, very much in their lexicon, so now they are very, very well versed in that regard. And so we can continue to do that. But there are those within, you know, our ranks who say, well, no. If we don't continue to travel, we're not going to be as attractive an organization to, as you mentioned, those students that are coming out of undergrad or postgrad who want to go out and see the world, who want to get real world experience in the international field to do this work. It's a bit of a quandary. So what we're doing at the moment is not mandating per se that we cannot travel or only one travel, one air flight per year for every sector or every team, but rather start to consider how we change our mindset, how to change our behaviors, because at the end of the day, that's what's going to make the difference, not just within PACT, but across the board, right? It's changing our behaviors. You mentioned air conditioning units, revolutionary, but they are now one of the main sort of culprits of greenhouse gas emissions.
Exactly. Right? I mean, that was the whole thing with Singapore, is that we've got to air condition everybody all the time. But in doing so, look how much energy is being burned in the process, right?
Exactly. And it's a vicious cycle, right? As we get more people, we need more AC units. As it gets hotter, we need more AC units, as we've seen in the U.S. Even now in Norway, when we arrived in July, there was 35 degrees Celsius weather, but none of the houses had AC units. Many of them didn't, but now they're starting to, because the climate is changing. And so we're in all those units, when they don't get maintained, they start to leak new refrigerants, and they are 60 times more potent than carbon dioxide in trapping, you know, the sun's rays, right, when it bounces off the earth. And so we are actually, that is very much a vicious circle there that needs to be broken. So we need to change our behaviors. Traveling, air travel is one way to do so. You know, do we go to the lengths of the Greta Thunbergs and others who have totally sworn off traveling by air? Is that realistic? It might be for some, depending on their work, on their type of work. For our work, when we're an international organization working in the international sphere, it's impossible to not travel to a certain extent, but we can reduce it somewhat. So what we're looking at is small but incremental fixes. Is it trying to consolidate our travel? So if I was to be going to Tanzania and then Madagascar 2 months later, consolidate those trips into one trip so that you're only doing that one long haul trip once. Paying a little extra, so you're going direct from, let's say, Ethiopia, Addis to Washington, D.C., or vice versa, versus going via Paris or London, which might be a nicer flight, but it means more emissions, because the most emissions that a plane emits is really from when they are taking off and landing. That's when primarily taking off. Once you get to cruising altitude, they actually expend quite a little emissions or gas. So we're looking at these types of issues, consolidating trips both across, within my own portfolio, but even within my team and even across teams. So being a little bit more efficient in the way that we do our work, and also thinking long and hard, is the travel I'm going to do essential? Can it be done by a local partner, our local staff, with a little help of remote help? some way say, well, if you're not in the long way, in a hotel in the long way, or in Dar es Salaam, then you're going to be put, you're going to be taken aside by some other project or some other burning issue, and you don't put your 24/7 attention to that project and to that partner, to that issue. So we're looking at ways to develop, you know, war rooms where you can put yourself, sequester yourself in an office for those 9 hours a day, and solely focus on your remote work. So there are many other ways we're doing this, but trying to reduce, you know, our travel by, let's say, 30% for now. And then the rest for now would also be, we're looking to carbon offsets. Not perfect, and we can get into that if you want, but a means to just at least while we are putting in these reduction measures, we can assure ourselves that we are doing good in terms of reforesting, afforesting, and sequestering emissions in the meantime.
It's, you know, David, just as we're covering so many issues here that are going to be inescapable issues that everyone is going to have to think about some way going forward, just much the same way as the pandemic made everyone globally connected through that shared experience, this emerging shared experience of adaptation to climate change is going to be that next step. And, you know, one of the elements that you touched on a couple times is the importance of having local partners in place when dealing with international work, and something that maybe traditionally some of the big funders have sort of paid lip service to, but not really invested with rubber on the road. And what I'm thinking of here is that when these strategies, if it is, you know, avoiding a greenhouse gas emitting air conditioner, if it's buying an electronic or electric vehicle, if it's getting off of single use plastics, whatever it is, it usually comes with some element of convenience, that there's more than just the moral concern for the environment that propels people to take these changes. And in that way, I know that's formally called something within environmental studies, and it escapes me at the moment, but I'm just thinking in terms of what we're doing here, the projects you're working on, and myself as a university educator, I'm looking at graduate programs that are continuing to accept students with this, you know, desire to take a degree, go travel, make the connections, come back, and then find employment. I'm wondering if there's not room and time right now for universities in the global north, especially international development programs, to really think about building capacity and training for communities in the global south, so that when these projects that are very important need to have local partners who are skilled and ready to work, that there's some sort of credential, there's some training that can be provided ahead of time. Is there anything that you've seen that would warrant that kind of action?
Yeah, so we do partner a lot, as I mentioned, with a lot of these local partners for that very reason, right? So that we are leaving that capacity. So we're developing. We don't call it capacity building, because that connotes that there is no capacity when you start. No, we are developing capacity so they can do the work for themselves. And so we're working with universities as well, and we do also work with U.S. universities to impart a lot of this knowledge, because a lot of it is we need to invest in the future, right? In terms of the future workforce, and in certain countries, you know, the youth bulge is very much a thing, and so we're working very much in that vein to essentially leave a legacy. And I'll give you an example. I mean, we were working in Vietnam with a project around health, and it was looking at developing the capacity of local NGOs and civil society groups. And so we brought together, you know, some various WIPSMART facilitators, and these three or four facilitators at the end of the project developed and created their own NGO, and now they themselves are doing the work for within Vietnam. They're Vietnamese, they're a Vietnamese NGO, and they're doing the work. So this has happened as well in Peru. You know, there was a PACT Peru, the PACT Peru office finished when the project ended because it was, you know, project based and project funding. And so when that finished, they went on, and with that capacity that they received, they were able to go on and become a bona fide consultancy doing supporting Peruvian projects around the clock. And so this is something that you know, the likes of PACT and Root Change, for example, which are actually a lot of PACT staff that became, you know, developed Root Change, are espoused. And I've definitely drunk the Kool-Aid, as you can hear. I mean, and it's nothing revolutionary, but at the same time, as you say, people pay a lot of lip service to it. But then when it comes to, you know, particularly private sector, international companies, there's a bottom line that they have to adhere to, they have to reach, and shareholders. And so if you pass on all the funding to local partners, it affects your bottom line, right? So what we've been also looking at is and this is something the World Economic Forum has touted a lot in recent years, is the fourth sector. It's not PPPs anymore, right? It's not public-private partnerships, but rather looking at ventures that are for benefit. They're for profits, but that they really are internalizing their what used to be environmental externalities, because they see that it positively impacts their supply chain or their bottom line. And it's not greenwashing, it's not corporate social responsibility, it's very much corporate shared value. So we work with the likes of Apple and Qualcomm and Shell and Nestle and others to support them to green their supply chains, whether it be from child labor or in terms of environmental risk mitigation. So this is something that we're going to continue to do, because, you know, ESG, you know, the environmental social governance safeguards and ESG profiles in the investment world are becoming very much a term de rigueur, and will continue to do so as we, the citizenry, we, the shareholders, request it. It's going to be an interesting next 10 years. I mean, I think, you know, ESG profile is going to be more important, if not more so, than your credit ratings. And so we're going to see a real shift, I do believe, and we're already seeing it in terms of the money that's pouring in into the sector. But the problem is, is there a business pipeline that can assimilate that funding? And we're seeing that is an issue. I'm moving a little away from your question, but it's an important one, where, you know, there are millions, if not trillions, of green financing out there, the likes of Green Climate Fund and Climate Investment Fund from the World Bank and multilateral institutions. But there's not enough capacity around the world to take that funding and implement projects effectively. So again, it comes back down to capacity development and developing the capacity of these organizations to do it for themselves. How are we going to get over this issue? When if can we do all this international work if we don't have travel? It works both ways, right? I mean, a lot of our projects have study tours where we bring local, you know, Ethiopian or Cambodian or Laotian students or technocrats back to the U.S. For example, when I used to work with Winrock, we did one where we took them to the northwest of the U.S. to look at payment for ecosystem services schemes, looking at how those worked. Where private sector would pay a third party to protect, let's say, or reforest areas of rivers to reduce the temperature, so salmon would come back and spawn. And then we showed Cambodians and Laotians how it works, and the fact that it's private sector run, it doesn't require government funding, so you don't have to think, oh, do I put money towards wash and electricity or food security or to safeguard this particular river? Then, you know, that decision is an obvious one if you're a policymaker. But if you have an ulterior way to do so, an alternative means of leveraging this financing, it can work. But you need travel to show this. You can't just explain it by virtue of on a Zoom call.
Exactly.
So it will be difficult. I don't have an answer. I mean, there is an answer. That is, in 10 years' time, our aviation industry will be much further ahead using biofuels, linked with the likes of the Dreamliners and Boeing and Airbus, who are making their planes lighter and lighter and lighter. The mixture of sustainable fuels and lighter aircraft will mean we will have more sustainable air travel. But that's not for another good 10, maybe even 20 years. So
exactly. And I think, David, you've hit it right there. It's going to be an interesting 10 years ahead. the solutions, we'd be naive to say we've got keyhole solutions to some of these challenges of climate adaptation going forward. But I think the conversation that you've shared with us today is one that, at the heart is optimistic, but it's also one that's grounded in the realities that we face in front of us today, in terms of how organizations are organized, in terms of what they seek in order to succeed, and in terms of what we really need in order to pursue these next 10 interesting years. So, David, I really want to thank you very much for joining us on GDP today. David Bonardo is the Director of the Environment for PactWorld.org. And David, thanks very much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much.